Hello and welcome. You're listening to Fourth Estate, the show where journalists talk journalism. Coming to you from 2SER in Sydney on the Gadigal lands of the Eora Nation, right across Australia on the Community Radio Network and directly to your device across the globe via podcast. My name is Peter Frey and I'm the co-director of the Centre for Media Transition at the University of Technology, Sydney. And my producers today are Anthony Dockrell and Julia Carr-Katzel. Today's show is all about shining some light on a dark and chilling week in Australian journalism. As you probably know, not one but two media organisations, News Corporation and the ABC, have been targeted by raids by the federal police who were searching for documents and other evidence. And in a separate matter, a commercial radio presenter, Ben Fordham, was warned off for simply reporting that up to six new boatloads of asylum seekers were on their way to Australia. But the raids were long and invasive. In the case of the News Corp journo Anika Smethurst, the cops turned up at her home and spent the day basically going through her home computer and other places where they might find some evidence. And in the other matter, several plainclothes officers visited the Ultimo office of the ABC, again spending up to about 8 hours sifting through data and documents and computers. Both cases involve the leaking of sensitive national security secrets. And the AFP says the raids were not directed by the government and they were not intended to intimidate journos. But in both cases, the police were looking to chase down the leakers, the whistleblowers, and they may also be looking, in a rather chilling development, at prosecuting the journalists involved. That's not yet clear, but it is possible. So the AFP says it's basically doing its job to protect the national security. Well, I would say, and I'm sure our panel will say, that journalists were simply doing their job of holding the powerful to account and publishing secrets. In the News Corp case, the secrets were plans to allow the Defence Spy Agency, the DSD, to use its surveillance powers against us, against Australian citizens. And in the ABC's case, the allegations were involving the activities of Australian special service soldiers serving in Afghanistan. More about that in a minute. Both stories were undoubtedly in the national interest, embarrassing as they may have been for the government and its agencies. So let's just briefly put in a bit of context here. There is nothing new about cops raiding journos, about cops tracking down the source of leaks and pursuing editors, publishers and reporters. What's unprecedented here is the concentrated nature of the action, two or three in a short space of time, the all-encompassing nature of the search warrants, especially in the ABC case, where the police had the power to not only search for information, but also delete information, and the outrage prompted by the raids across the news media industry and anyone else committed to press freedom. There is a palpable sense of shock. There is a real sense of unity among journos and their supporters. So today I want to explore what next. Will the outrage last? And if so, to what end? Is this a watershed moment for press freedom in this country? Or will, as one journo with first-hand experience of being raided told me earlier today, the outrage will be over by Sunday? His point is that both the main parties, the Coalition and Labor, passed tough security legislation last year. So there is another unity ticket going on, if you like, and that is politicians sticking together and only paying lip service to press freedom in matters involving national security. So who knew that Peter Dutton was such a persuasive guy? I'm going to explore these and other questions with a fabulous panel in a minute or two. But first, I canvassed a few of the views of journalists working at the Coalface and a media scholar with some expertise in the area. Damien Cave, the head of the New York Times' bureau in Australia, has suggested that Australia may be the world's most secretive democracy as a result of these raids. Damien joins me on the line now. Hello, Damien.
Hi.
So maybe you can expand on that a bit, because that's quite a claim.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't my claim. This is the claim of experts who know Australian law and democracy even better than me. And their argument is that you just have to look at the evidence. I mean, these raids are just the latest example of a trend that's been going on for a long time, but especially since 9/11, where laws have been added and amended to make secrecy the dominant law of the land. It's all based on, many of this stuff, on a law from 1914, which was used for the warrant for the ABC, And it basically says that no one can share anything with their boss's permission, right? That's what the law says. And
exactly.
if you take that and then you add to that all these layers of new laws, more than 60 since 9/11, more than any other democracy in the world, you end up with a country that is arguably the most secretive developed democracy in the world. I don't think that actually is as surprising or shocking to those who really look at this stuff with international perspective.
But when you were sent, when you came here a few years ago, at no point would you have thought, hey, I'm going off to the world's most secretive democracy, right?
No, absolutely not. I mean, the image that Australia sends out to the world is, look at how open and blunt we are. And I think that's very much a part of the national character. But the divide between the way government works and the way the culture works is enormous. And, you know, a lot of Australians maybe haven't even recognized themselves this power grab, this degree of overreach the government has been engaged in for really quite a long time.
So a final question, do you think this is the events of the last few days are a sort of watershed?
You know, I'm really curious to see if that's the case. I think it's really interesting that, you know, these raids, the government is targeting a wide range of journalists from News Corp to the ABC, and they're targeting stories that are kind of quite clearly in the public interest. So, you know, this has the potential to really change the game, at least in terms of the media, in terms of the momentum. You know, many of us have been talking privately, frankly, about these issues of transparency and secrecy for a long time behind the scenes. There's a lot of outrage at senior levels of journalism in Australia that has been building for a very long time. But at the end of the day, this only works if the public gets behind us. You know, the media is not very well trusted. We could all do a better job of doing our jobs and explaining why things like transparency matter. And so no matter how outraged we all get as part of our little tribe, it can only go so far if the public's behind us.
Joining me now is Johan Ligberg, a journalism scholar and an expert in press freedom from Monash University, whose most recent book is called In the Name of Security, Secrecy, Surveillance and Journalism. It's a very fine book, and we've done a whole episode on it on the Fourth Estate. Johan, thanks for coming on the show.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Just to deal with this, what's really been going on behind the scenes in terms of legislation, the amendments to security laws last year, supported by both the government and the Labor opposition, means that journalists could be charged with committing a crime if they publish information regardless of intent to endanger national security. So Australia doesn't have a Charter of Rights or a First Amendment like the US. So is it time we have in our laws an explicit right to freedom of the press in our democracy? And if so, what does that look like?
Absolutely. I mean, we have been discussing a Bill of Rights or a Charter, whatever you want to call it, for decades now in Australia. But I think we have to be realistic and just admit that we're not going to get a Bill of Rights. Because Australians don't really like changing constitution and so on. So I think the most quickest and reasonable thing to do is to come up with some sort of Media Freedom Act. I know Peter Grestia has suggested one and his organisation to come up with a white paper, and I think that would be the most doable thing. I mean, it's at the moment, with the recent amendments that you were talking about, it's impossible to keep track of all this. You know, from a working journalist point of view, how can you ask of anyone to be able to keep track of these 64-plus amendments and changes and new laws that have been passed since 2001? So it sort of sends the message of stay away from reporting national security and terrorism issues because it's just too hard.
Yeah, it's the chilling effect, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. So this act would somehow need to bring together everything that is now sort of floating around. So we've got shield laws for journalists that are protecting their sources, which is in all jurisdictions but one now in Australia. But we don't really know how they're going to work because it's up to each presiding judge to apply them. Mm-hmm. There's two or three test cases, but will they really work? That needs to be brought in. We need to have this Act 2 needs to somehow deal with this huge blanket that has been created by all these new laws and acts that have come through. So it needs to set out, I suppose, the ground playing rules, the baseline between journalism and the state.
Well, so I guess the central question here is how do we, very broadly, journalism, academics, the news media industry, supporters of, you know, democracy, freedom of the press, how does this happen? A statement was put out by JIRA, which is the Journalism Education Association, and you were part of that. which, you know, describes the problem. I think we're very good at describing the problem.
Mm.
The question really is, how do we galvanize this moment and turn it into action? Because, frankly, I think the Press Freedom Act that Peter Greste is talking about was far more likely to happen if we had had a change of government a few weeks ago. And maybe I'm wrong, but it doesn't seem that the coalition government is particularly going to be up for it. How do we change that?
So I think you're right there. It's pretty safe to say that the current government has got very, very little interest in this. The opposition needs to step up. I mean, the Labour Party has clearly been very much part of creating the current national security climate that we're in Australia. So they need to somehow step up and really take this to the government now and take the side of actually meaningfully redrawing the base playing rules for media and journalism in this country in relation to national security. So I think the way forward is to engage with the opposition on this and via them trying to engage the government. But yeah, in the current climate, it's hard to see how it would actually happen.
Joining me now is Leo Shanahan, the newly minted media editor of The Oz, and he has a job on Sky News. Congratulations on the new job. What's the part of Sky News again?
I'm co-host of Business Weekend with Tiki Fullerton on Sky.
What an interesting pairing. Let's cut to the chase here. What impact do you think these raids will have on the news media industry?
Yeah, Peter, I don't think anything quite galvanizes the media like an attack on the idea of their freedom and their ability to report. And I think in this instance, we've seen that. It's the images themselves are confronting, and you have AFP officers leaving the house of Annika Smithurst, as well as the ABC yesterday. But it's the power behind these raids, I think, which is disturbing, and the breadth of these warrants that the police carry with them.
Yeah, it's remarkable, isn't it? I mean, the warrant in the ABC matter enabled them to delete information. I've never heard of that before.
And seemingly, these are national security issues involved. And I think a point to make here is that this happens a lot more often than perhaps people realise to journalists. These two cases being so close together, and I suppose the public nature of them has attracted a lot of publicity. But I mean, for example, and I tell this story not to talk myself up, I mean, it just shows that this happens quite regularly. A couple of years ago, the ICAC came up to my office, I think you were my editor back then, and took notebooks and recordings of an interview I did with the OBIDs.
Mm.
I then been asked to cooperate in a trial in evidence against them. There's another case where I've been a subject of my interviews is now being charged under a National Security Act to do with ACES. I could be called up into that anytime soon. I won't be able to talk about that because that's all covered by national security legislation. Now, the point is that this actually happens a fair bit. And to most journalists I know, this has happened in some way or another. And the question is, what is our capacity to do about it as a kind of more united front? And do we possess that capacity longer term to maintain the rage?
Yeah, well, that's the key thing. And I think, I'm not sure what your view is, but it seems to me that the news media industry can't necessarily do this one on its own. I mean, we've had the Right to Know Coalition for quite some time. It's done some great work, but you know, we still had Labour and the coalition joining together last year to pass these new laws. So, what needs to happen is a really interesting question. What's your thoughts?
Yeah, and I mean, I'm not a constitutional expert, but I do understand that within our constitution, it's only a read in notion of freedom of the press by a couple of big court cases in the High Court. It's not actually explicit in the First Amendment sense. So there are other much more protective laws in the US for journalists. And I think as a body, there's nothing more powerful than the media companies who can agree on an issue and put pressure on governments. They're extremely powerful at the best of times individually. And if they do possess that capacity to band together, I would imagine governments would be pretty loath to put up much of a defence.
Leo, before I let you go, I believe there's going to be more raids. Is that your understanding?
Look, Peter, I can't comment too much on that, but what I could say is that the Australian reported this morning there was an expectation of further raids at News Corp, and those did not eventuate.
It's not clear why the AFP has taken so long to get around to knocking on the door, and the government has been at pains to distance itself from the timing. In other words, it's got nothing to do with the fact the election is over and the coalition is back in power. I personally am not so sure about that, but maybe I'm just a cynical journalist. I am reliably told, though, that Smethurst knew that something like this would happen immediately after she published her piece, because one of the parts of that story was that they published a picture of the actual leaked document, and that was prima facie evidence that the secret document had been passed to a journo, and that is very much covered by this new legislation. Just before we get to the panel, I just wanted to explore how we got to this point. Last year, just to be clear, the government with Labor's aid passed new security laws creating a new offence, the offence of, quote, dealing in classified information, especially in information relating to national security. And in that word dealing includes the words handling, communicating and retaining classified information. And in that word communicating takes in what journalists do, i.e. publishing. So up to then, publishing itself was not an offence. So now the new laws do include a public interest test, and that's kind of the SOP to journalism, but that public interest test has not yet been tested. And as publishers only know too well, defending a publication on national security grounds is going to cost a lot of money, a lot of time, a lot of effort. So there's a real danger here that there will be a chilling effect on the actions of journalists and whistleblowers. In short, press freedom in Australia and the world, but in Australia, is threatened. Let's turn to our panel. We've got a lot to discuss, so we've recruited just the right panel to do so. We have, in no particular order, but I'm going to introduce Marcus Strom first, who is the president of the Journalists Union, the MEAA. He is a former Fairfax journalist of some note, great science reporter, among other things. Fantastic sub. I could just go on. And now you're at University of Sydney. Hello, Marcus.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for having me on.
Great pleasure. Yarrabu Mellum is a Walkley winning video journalist. Her reporting has taken her all over the world. She's just got back from Berlin. She looks a little bit jet-lagged. She's been to Syria, Libya, you name it. She's been there. She's done that. And most recently, or really interestingly, she's been doing some fantastic work about press freedom in our region, in particular the Philippines. Hello.
Great to be here.
Great. Thanks for coming on. And David Skopinka, who has revealed to me just a few minutes ago that he was one of the original driving forces to join the Right to Know Coalition, which is a public Right to Know Coalition, which has previously unified the media industry around these issues. He is currently the head of Telemedia, where he specializes in media and in corporate affairs. And you've had a lot of experience in Australia and the UK. And interestingly, in Telem, because why, apart from many other reasons to have you on the show, David, is that Telem kind of has a kind of helicopter view of what's going on in the industry.
That's right. Thank you so much for having me. I think my boss would say she was probably the driving force of the Right to Know campaign, but it was a lot of fun to work on it and super interesting.
So let's start with this unity ticket in news media. The country's news media has spoken, the likes of the Oz, the Sydney Morning Herald, the Guardian, Sky News, the Telegraph. This story has led all their bulletins, websites and websites. There's been a lot of outrage. Really interesting, I think, was the ABC during the raids in Ultimo, where the head of investigations, John Lyons, documented the raids with Twitter, copying the first two pages of the warrant. And it was great work by John, if you're listening. He was witness to 9 hours of worth of warrant documents, data uploads, coffee. John tweeted the entire process saying, "I've never seen an assault on the media as savage as this. I've never seen a warrant this comprehensive and I'd say scary. The chilling message is not so much for journalists, but it's also for the public." Marcus, how did we get to this point? Did this come out of a blue sky or has this been building up?
This has been building up for years, if not decades, probably since 9/11, 2001. Mm-hmm. That there's been, I think, at least 13 or 14 iterations of reviews of national security laws since then that has ratcheted up the ability for the police and the government to censor what is done in the media in the interests of so-called national security, which of course is a legitimate concern for governments. But it's been a game of brinkmanship and bluff by both major parties, neither of which wants to open a fight with the other on national security or be seen to be weak on national security. So oppositions have just let these so-called reforms pass through.
Well, it's become a bit like the, you know, the asylum seeker issue, hasn't it? No one party wants to blink.
Yeah, so we've ended up with a bunch of laws that allow the AFP to do what they did. So in that sense, it's not really the AFP's fault.
Sure.
It is a political and legislative climate that the major political parties have allowed to grow. And what government eventually, or what police force eventually, doesn't use the powers that it can use?
Oh, that's right. I mean, almost it's compelled to do so. Just we spoke to Damien Cave from the New York Times earlier, and he has written a piece talking about Australia being the most secretive democracy in the world. Yara, how does that make you feel?
Oh, well, as a freelance...
Well, you travel all over the world.
Exactly. I travel all over the world, and I cover issues relating to journalists coming under the wrong side of the law or under the hammer by authoritarian regimes. And I suppose what I found really poignant about the raids is when Gavin Morris, the director of News and Current Affairs at the ABC, who was named in the warrant, came outside and said, journalism is not a crime, which is the same sort of line that you hear from embattled journalists in mostly authoritarian regime-run countries. And here we have the director of News and Current Affairs at the ABC, the public broadcaster, saying journalism is not a crime because now journalists in Australia are heavily under assault. And so this is something that's concerning not just for journalists, but anyone who cares about upholding the public's right to know about certain things and also keeping power accountable, because that is what our job is essentially.
That's what we do. Let's go back to a point that I think Marcus made, and that is, so there is a balance here. I mean, I want to shed some light here. There is a balance between, if you like, the limits of the public interest or national interest and this right to know concept. So how do we, David, this is a tricky question, but how do we go about balancing that? Right? How do we keep secrets but actually do our job?
I think that is the crux of the issue entirely. I think, Peter Credlin had a segment on Sky last night talking about exactly this. She came out, on the side of government, on the side of the current set of laws, basically saying that, Cabinet needs the opportunity to discuss and come up with proposals.
I'm shocked.
That's her point of view, to come up with proposals in private. The process in this particular instance, talking about Annika Smethurst's case, was that the Cabinet shot down the proposals point blank. But even if it had gone through to be debated in Parliament, it would have been done so in open light. Now,
We don't know that.
But in order to change legislation, her argument was in order to change legislation, it would have had to have been debated in Parliament. Mm. And therefore, people would have known about it. And therefore, it wasn't a whistleblower. It was simply a leaker. So I take the point. However, what I think is really disturbing is that you've got a situation where government is regulating media. Whether you agree that Julian Assange is a journalist or not, the Australian media kind of came out and said, look, we take, and American media, Western media came out very strongly and said, the media takes a lot of care to make sure that what is released is, okay for informants. It's not going to hurt them. It's not going to, hurt national security, et cetera, et cetera. And yet now we're in a situation where government seems to be regulating that exact point. So editorial process seems to be taken away or being taken away from the newsrooms, which I think is quite
okay, that's
quite
a very, very point. So Marcus, good point from David. What needs to happen? I mean, we have an inflection point here, right? I do think it's a watershed. So what we've got an opportunity. There's a crisis. Never waste a good crisis.
What's been revealed is the complete inadequacy of the laws that govern these matters, and we need a positive defence and a positive protection in the laws for whistleblowers and journalists. At the moment, all that exists is a right to defend yourself, given a national a public interest test.
So it's in the breach, in other words.
Yes, it's in the breach where it should be a positive protection. That's what actually needs to happen. And also, the government is riven with hypocrisy. This was a politically motivated attack on journalism designed to intimidate whistleblowers and journalists. The government ministers leak sensitive information constantly to their pet newspapers and then front them days later and say, sure. Oh, yes, I can confirm that story is actually true.
They fly it up the flag.
Yeah, and does the AFP investigate those? No, they do not. Ooh. That is a political decision. It's not an operational decision. That's a political decision. There are cabinet breaches constantly in Parliament, and if it's a leak to promote a policy by the government, it's ignored.
Oh, but we should also say that all governments are the same.
Absolutely. Labor was just absolutely. It's the political process.
They want it both ways, in other words.
It's very cynical. They want it both ways. They want to control the message. I mean, if government had its way, all the newspapers would do was publish press releases put out by ministers.
So just to expand on this a bit on what needs to happen, Peter Greste and others have put up this media freedoms bill, this kind of omnibus idea that essentially media freedom would be enshrined as a sort of central tenet in all legislation. This is kind of a checklist. Oh, does this impinge on media freedom? Is that where we should be going?
Yeah, something along that. So if you read every year, MIA, our union, puts out its annual press freedom report.
Mm.
And we've been saying year after year that there needs to be a positive protection for journalists and whistleblowers enshrined in law. This is not a new call, but I'm glad that it's crystallising and it looks, yes, there's a crisis, and I'm hoping that the media companies, the publishers, the law reform organisations can come together and put maximum pressure on the Parliament to try and put their money where their mouth is, which is they say they're in favour of press freedom. Okay, let's see it. Let's see it in practice. Change the law.
David, one of the reasons we were actually going to talk about the state of the jobs in the industry, I mean, I think that the week's events have sort of taken us beyond that, but we will get back to that. But you have a kind of helicopter view of the industry. How do you see sort of events like this shaping the kind of way forward for journalism, in particular young journalists who are thinking about, you know, going into the industry?
I think, you know, when journalists who want to be investigative journalists and who imagine winning a Walkley and want to get on the front page, you know, into the industry, that's a huge number of those journos. I think the challenge of something like this is that we're moving away from journalism and into content. So people are no longer going into the industry to be journalists. That shoe leather reporting, you know, is becoming, you know, far more infrequent and harder to do. There are pockets of, you know, growth there. You know, what's happening down at Crikey is really interesting, and, you know, Nine is hiring some great people, but it's really small pockets of exciting new things. So I think, you know, the definition of what is journalism is changing for exactly these reasons. People ask, you know, I'm not going to say that the people I speak to are scared, but I've certainly heard stories of, you know, seasoned journalists going through their houses in the last couple of days and throwing things away, or clearing them, moving them to the office, not destroying evidence like that, but just moving them.
Well, of course, the AFP didn't search Annika's office at all.
No, they searched straight to the house. Straight to the house. That's an interesting. Do you have any theory on that? Does anyone have a theory on why they went to the house, not to the press gallery?
I know nothing. I
mean, obviously, they knew stuff.
You know, I know nothing in particular, but I mean, you know, look, I've worked for big organisations where left hand doesn't talk to right hand, and you release things publicly, you know, in an order that's probably not great. But one raid on a journalist is sort of, you know, a big deal. Two in 2 days is either deliberate or a serious stuff up somewhere along the way in terms of public perception, or it's intended.
Well, it seems intentional, doesn't it?
Exactly.
It does seem like the public and
journalists and whistleblowers from putting out any information.
Well, we spoke to Leo Shanahan from the Australian, the new media editor there, and they were expecting a raid today.
Yes, I've heard that from a few places. I don't know where, but to have two, and the AFP have been at pains to say that these cases are not connected whatsoever.
Ooh.
So the only thing that connects them is their timing. Ooh. So their timing is deliberate, and it is a clear attempt to intimidate whistleblowers and journalists. And that if it is true that there was a third one being planned and that they pulled out of it, they did not expect the backlash. And that gives me hope, gives me confidence. And journalists and, you know, people who, dare I say it, freedom lovers, people who are pro-democracy, should take heart from that, that we can fight back against draconian attacks on a free press. And that is what this is. And if they've been beaten back to only have 2 out of 3 raids, great. They're threatening more in the press conference they've just given. But we should put maximum pressure on them, and we should put maximum pressure on politicians to change the law and to stop police raids on journalists.
How empathetic, I mean, this is for you, Yaron, and the rest of the panel. You know, no one, in my view, goes into journalism to be loved. It's not that game, right? We don't do it to be loved by the citizens. But and yet, really, for this to happen, for this movement to really take hold, we have to gather public support as well. How do we go about that?
For journalism?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I think there needs to be some sort of education, I suppose, for the public to understand that journalism, that the role of journalism has always been to act as the fourth estate, to be a check on the balances, on
Marcus, you got any plans at the union for this?
So I think we need to go. I actually don't think this is about journalism.
You being it's about democracy.
This is about democracy. This is about the citizens being able to have access to information. This is about a government that wants to make decisions in secret without transparency. This is a culture of keep people ignorant and make decisions behind their back. It is about democracy. Journalism is the messenger, and also, yes, we are the fourth estate that holds people to account. So we need to reach out to the public, and if it's about journalism or journalists, yeah, the public will go, who cares?
Right.
It has to be about them. It has to be about democracy. It's about their right to know. It's about their democratic access to information, and we are the conduits for that information.
Well, David, you've got a marketing brain among your journalistic brain. How would you go about selling that to the public?
Wow, that's a big question.
I know. I'm trying to make us all lots of money.
Yeah.
Well, Marcus lots of money anyway.
I think first of all, it's not an overnight thing. You don't just put out a campaign or a billboard or a nice YouTube ad. It doesn't just happen that quickly. I think the greatest thing that probably needs to happen is the media needs to continue and enhance its reporting that it's currently doing to show its value. I mean, you know, you've seen, for example, in the US, the New York Times, who has kind of been pretty fearless, and the Washington Post as well, and others, who've been fearless in reporting in the face of a lot of, you know, backlash from an administration. People now appreciate this kind of voice. They appreciate that their freedoms and their right to know things.
Well, certain people do, right? I think this is the issue, isn't it?
Certainly. I don't think Australia is America. I don't think there's a division quite the same way that there is here that there is there.
Well, they have press freedom protections.
They certainly have a First Amendment.
So,
yeah, they certainly do.
Don't have to think about it.
So I think, in the last 2 decades, we've seen the weakening of newsrooms. Mm. And I think we've seen governments the world over trying to take advantage of that. I mean, it was typified by Scott Morrison trapping all the gallery journalists on a bus while he did a walkabout in a shopping centre, and he didn't allow the press gallery to go with them. Mm. It is a cynical attempt to take advantage of a somewhat weakened news culture given the loss of funding and so on. And it's not just from government, it's from corporates as well. I mean, from Media Watch this week, the Adani tooling up to intimidate the ABC or intimidate other news organisations to get its message across. And I think what we have to do as journalists, and this is what the union is about not just building alliances with publishers, but empowering our members to be confident to fight back. I mean, as we've been talking, I've had a text message from the head of the House Committee at the Sydney Morning Herald saying they've just met, they've had photos, they've passed a solidarity motion with the ABC and News Corp, and we're putting out a call this afternoon across all newsrooms, calling on similar actions across the country to stand up and say, we won't be intimidated, journalism is not a crime.
We're going to be on a unity ticket with Marcus Strom and Miranda Devine.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's my dream. Miranda Devine, David Marr together campaigning.
I think it will happen. I do really think it will happen. It just, we're running out of time, but I did want to touch on the Adani story. What I'm still unclear about, and if anyone has got any insight. So the Adani calls up and says, hey, you know, we've been asked these questions which indicate, you know, you don't understand the story. Now, there's nothing new in that whatsoever. What seems to be remarkable about what happened next is that then the story doesn't get run. And not just in Saturday AM where it was due to be run on the ABC, but not at all. So Adani appears to have won in this matter. Do you have any thoughts about that, Yara?
I don't know if they've won. Now it's sort of
been... Well, they were just talking about it all the time. Yeah, maybe they haven't.
Yeah, I mean, now it's sort of been revealed that they have this sort of machinery in place to silence journalism and silence journalists and silence any criticism. So I think... that makes them look really bad. It's a very NRA lobby style tactic that they're using here, where they're just going to bark and bite as many journalists as they can, or as many critics as they can.
But as David said, you know, we are in a shifting space in terms of journalists. We have lots of people who still believe in the mission, as it were, but there's a lot of people going into the industry, possibly not to take it to the man, so to speak. Right.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely fair. I mean, when you look at, so Telum has a database of basically every journalist in Australia. That's
You surveil us.
Not exactly, no. But that's kind of the idea, is so that, you know, people know who's doing what in the industry. And when you look at it, I mean, yes, general news is still the largest sector by far in Australia. But then very close behind is lifestyle and entertainment and sport. You know, I mean, it's not investigative journalism.
Is that become more prevalent in that sense?
The lifestyle space, the entertainment space, you know, the softer stuff that gets the clicks and gets the views, that's certainly growing.
Well, so, I don't think that's a problem. I mean, journalism does need to
make money.
It needs to have a sustainable model.
We've always had the colour supplement.
And that stuff can fund the investigative reporting. And I don't think that people who are doing the lifestyle content, you know, clickbait sort of thing are going to go after the Adanis of the world. That will be the investigative reporters. Mm. And they're
question is whether where the money is going from to do investigations, say, for instance.
Well, that's why you have the lifestyle entertainment clickbait.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, I guess, is it being spent on investigative journalism?
There needs
point.
To be that balance.
I mean, the fight we used to have in Fairfax all the time, we would say to Greg Highwood, you're making squillions of dollars in domain, why don't you use that?
And we know what happened.
To subsidize.
why don't you
use that to subsidize investigative journalism? And he was saying, oh, no, the news has to wash its own face. I learned all these accounting McKinsey type
exactly. Jargons. And what happened was that they ended up separating domain from the rest of the, you know, the journalistic body, and now it's the only thing that's worth any money.
What we were originally going to talk today, I think there is a bit of confidence returning to newsrooms.
Yep.
At the ABC, I mean, I had lunch with John Lyon the other day, and he's saying he thinks he's overseeing one of the largest investigative teams in the world. There are 30 people at the ABC who just do investigations.
Yeah, that's huge. And
it's one of the biggest teams in the world. You've got investment in Crikey. I think you've got sub-editors coming back to the Sydney Morning Herald, The Age and The Fin Review. So membership of the union is, you know, had flatlined and is going up a little bit. So I think there are springs of, you know, buds of spring.
So final question, bringing it back to what we've been talking about mainly, is will this help or hinder that trend? Yara, do you think more people want to be a journalist because they can get raided by the AFP?
Oh, no, definitely not. I don't think more. I think young journalists wanting to come into the industry will look at this and be like, oh, do I really want to have that sort of life? It's not glamorous. Journalism is by no means glamorous unless you take the softer approach to things.
Okay. Marcus, what do you think about that?
I'm not so sure about that. I think the romance of... the romance of journalism could have got a bit of a resuscitation from this, that it's reminded people of what our mission is. Handling classified information is what journalists do, and it's seen as the sort of the pinnacle, the peak, the most romantic. And
All right. Where do you stand on the romantic notion or not, David?
I think it will certainly reinvigorate people. And just from a Telum perspective, what I can tell you is that over the last few years, we haven't seen the number of journalists in Australia decrease. We've actually seen that increase.
Right. As I say, that was what we were going to talk about today.
Yeah.
I mean, we'll talk about it very soon.
No, but I think, you know, just to sort of finish that off, I think, you know, people aren't exiting the industry in droves.
Are you talking about graduates or are you talking about
generally speaking, the whole industry is growing. That's what we see. Now, it's changing in shape, but, you know, certainly the actual number of people creating news, you know, what we would consider to be news and content in that sense is growing.
Well, maybe this will increase both, right? We'll have more lifestyle journalists, which is what where that growth is, I'm assuming.
It's all over the show.
Okay, and we're going to have more investigative journalists too, which is perhaps a happy note to end this
show. And more members for the union.
It's happy Marcus Strong. Okay, well, we've been talking to Marcus Strong, the federal president of the MEAA, the Journalist Union, to Yarrabul Mellum, who is a Walkley Award-winning freelance video maker, journalist extraordinaire, investigative journalist extraordinaire, I might add, and David Skopinka, the head of Telemedia, and many other things. Thank you so much, all three of you, for coming along.
Thanks, Peter.
Great to be here.
And thanks, everyone, for listening to The Fourth Estate. This edition was recorded at the studios of 2SER and heard across the country on the Community Radio Network. Make sure you're subscribed to The Fourth Estate on your favorite podcast app so you can hear us talk media, politics, and a few things in between at your leisure. And we'll be back with more next week. But in the meantime, you can stay in touch with us on Twitter, where our handle is Fourth Estate AU. Many thanks to my producers, Anthony Dockrell and Julia Carr-Katzel. My name is Peter Frey. Thanks very much for listening.